You're listening to a Radio 191 FM podcast.
Hi.
Hello.
Welcome to Required Reading.
I'm Charlie.
And I'm Amy.
And we are two unqualified Otago students.
And in this podcast, we discuss books and sometimes their adaptations, mostly so we can avoid our uni work. Today, we're talking about Little Women by Louisa May Alcott and also Anne of Green Gables by L.M. Montgomery.
We're talking about Sisterhood, Timothy Chalamet Goop, How to Tell Which Season It Is, Overcoming Personal Failings, and of course, Fast and the Furious. Stay tuned to find out more. So our first episode was released last week. Pretty exciting, Wuthering Heights.
It was
critically
reviewed
by our friends and family. Everybody seemed to really like it, which is awesome.
Yeah, my mum enjoyed it. She's listened to it 3 times. My grandma sent a message that said, "Brilliant, fantastic, love it. Thank you, everyone."
Everyone.
And so we'd like to say thank you, everyone, to you.
Yeah, because we believe that when she said thank you, everyone, she was referring to so much more than just Amy and I. She was referring
all
to the universe, the
fans,
the listeners, Apple, Spotify. I don't know, maybe Jeff Bezos. We don't know who
Not
she was
Jeff
referring
Bezos,
to.
She wouldn't. Why would we be thanking Jeff Bezos?
I don't know. I was just thinking capitalism and shit. Let's move on. Okay, so this episode we are talking about Little Women and Anne of Green Gables. Kind of a strange combination.
Is it?
But like they weren't really released at the same time. No. It's kind of the only, but there are a lot of similarities between the two.
Yeah.
Right? I mean, firstly, they are just complete and utter delight.
Joy.
Like you can't.
Pages and pages of joy.
You can't read them and not be happy.
You read chapters and you just smile at the paper.
Yep. Yeah.
It's like lolling out loud, you know?
Exactly. And like, and also just the way that it's structured is quite similar as well. It's just very vignette style storytelling, just like a lot of little stories that all together make up a whole, you know? And there is still that serial storyline in both.
And
but
the thing that's kind of unusual about them for at the time is they're quite quiet stories. You know, there's not a lot of really important or fast-paced plot, and it's mostly these stories about women, mostly, and how they behave in relationships together and what that does to their lives, which is like we see more now, but at the time, these books were like quite hard to publish, but they did really well.
Yeah, written by and for women, which, you know, is pretty common these days.
I love when stories about women are written by women.
I hate it. I just don't think it's realistic enough. I feel like
really
a man has a better grasp.
You know,
yeah. But I also think a fun little thing that
this
they have in common
good.
Is that both authors have the initials L.M.
Mm-hmm.
Louisa May.
Lucy Maud.
Such good fun. So those are just kind of why we're putting them together. And as we sort of briefly touched upon in Normal People, I mean, tell me that Anne of Green Gables isn't spring and Little Women isn't
autumn.
It's so true.
And like what better time to listen to this, you know, than going into winter?
Exactly. In between. Mm-hmm. In between the 2 months. What comes after winter?
Spring. So we're going into the month sandwiched by Little Women.
So we're in autumn?
Going into, yeah.
Okay.
Have you seen the leaves?
Yeah. I'm not very good with months.
Me neither.
Months and seasons?
I don't understand
how
people know when they start. They're like, oh, it's, you know, winter on Saturday.
Yeah.
Okay, how do you know that? It's the same as how my dad always knows when the summer solstice is.
What?
And the equinox.
How? Why?
I don't know.
It's quite simply confusing. And I just sort of walk around and go,
just
oh,
go
it's
by the vibes.
Slightly colder today. It must be the middle of winter, even if it's April.
Although, like, lately I've been thinking that it is winter because Met Service keeps going, it's going to be 11 degrees. Met Service has been wrong for the last 3 weeks. So
yeah.
I don't know who to believe.
I think we should probably move on to the books. as we were talking about with the historical context, like, obviously, these sorts of books were pretty uncommon at the time. Little Women was released in 1868, and Anne of Green Gables exactly 40 years later. Sorry, just trying to do some maths. 1908. Is that 40?
I don't know. I'm not. I have no numerical literacy.
I think that's 40 years.
My brain says 60, but that's not right.
But very interestingly, both of the authors took heavy inspiration from their own lives in
super
writing these books. Incredibly. Yeah. So, like, for example, L.M. Montgomery, who's the author of Anne of Green Gables, like, in her own childhood, she grew up on Prince Edward Island. And she said
that she too.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah. I don't know how big the island is, though.
I think it maybe like Stewart Island sized.
You have no idea.
I don't know.
That's just what we vibe with.
You know.
Yeah. But she said that she felt like an orphan after her mum died. And she was very particular that her name Maud be spelt without an E. Very similar to how Anne is very particular that her name is spelt with an E.
Yeah. I do like that she's so strong in this thought about Maud without an E, but I disagree with her wholeheartedly. Maud with an E has way better vibes than Maud without an E.
I totally agree. I feel like it just stops too short. You know? Like, Maud should not be a four-letter word. There's too many...
You need to have that length, the Maud.
Yeah, exactly. And otherwise, how would I know to say the word for that long? I would just go Maud.
Maud.
See, completely wrong, but it needs to be Maud. See, how much nicer is
so
that?
Much nicer. So, Little Women, essentially when they showed the manuscript to the publishing men, they all went, this is fucking boring. But Alcott brought it home and gave it to her like nieces and the other girls that are around. And they fucking loved it. They wanted more. They wanted more and more and more. And Alcott said that they were the best critics. And so they agreed to publish it. And it was a sensation.
It was. I mean, both of these books were absolute sensations when they came out.
And still are.
Yeah. They were the 50 Shades of Grey of 1868 and 1908 in terms of just taking the world by storm.
No, they were the Harry Potter.
I disagree. Okay, so as per, we have a little fun fact at the beginning
up,
of every episode. Yeah, yeah, because, I mean, we're pretty stiff.
We don't have a good rapport or anything, so we just have to... get going.
Exactly. We need to like make sure that our conversation is really flowing. So yeah, my fun fact is that the original manuscript for Anne of Green Gables was rejected from every publisher. So Lucy Maud without an E put it in a hat box for 2 years. Then she later reread it and was like,
still good.
Hold on. This is fucking good.
I really
good.
Did something
this
here.
This slaps, and I simply need to make sure that it gets published. And she sent it out again, and it was immediately published and became a bestseller. So what do we learn? What do we learn from this story, Amy?
It ages like a fine wine.
It ages like a fine wine. And we also learn to never give up on your dreams.
So true. Girl boss. A girl boss wouldn't give up. Okay.
So true.
I have two fun facts, actually. So greedy. Louisa May Alcott. Greedy.
Yeah.
They're good ones.
All right.
So the Alcott family, for a year, they lived in a commune. They didn't like it. They left. They also have no record of their time in the commune. They just lived in a commune. It was called the Utopian Fruitlands.
The Utopian Fruitlands.
Utopian Fruitlands. Sounds like
that
a cereal.
That sounds kind of fun.
It does sound fun.
This sounds like a fun cereal or like a fun theme park or something.
It sounds like a movie that like Kristen Bell would be in.
Kristen Bell?
Kristen Bell. Oh, no.
Kristen Bale?
No, Kristen Bell.
Frozen. Are you bringing back Frozen again?
No.
You need to stop slipping
like,
Frozen
you know,
into
she's in The Good Place. And then, anyway. The other one is, so the family were staunch Union fighters during the Civil War. And for a while, they served as station masters to an underground railroad. I want to know more about that.
This sounds fascinating.
Why was the railroad underground? What was it doing? Was it a secret? So when I was looking at this fact, it was underground railroad. Capitalized. So this seems like there was only one.
Yeah, the Underground Railroad system is like a specific thing during the Civil War.
Shut up. You don't know. Anyway.
Yes, I do. It's also it's also not literally underground.
What? Are you kidding?
No, I'm not.
Oh,
I'm not.
Fuck. Anyway, they held a fugitive black slave for a month when he ran away. They safe havened him.
Oh, okay. They helped him. Just the word fugitive made it seem like they held the slave hostage.
No, no. They kept him safe for a week until he get further north and free.
Just thinking, just remembering, kind of bouncing off your Utopian Fruitlands. Actually, this is completely unrelated, but I'm going to say it anyway.
Bouncing off.
Did you know that there's a YA novel based on L. M. Montgomery's life called Maud?
No.
YA novel. So strange. Why?
YA?
Shut up. Okay. Let's move on.
We seem abrasive today. Okay. So, Little Women. I'm going to give you a little bit of backstory, then I'm going to give you a little bit of plot. But we've decided not to give you the entire plot because you can watch the fantastic 2020 movie if you want to get into the Little Women world.
Or read the book.
Or read the book.
It's also like, what's the point in telling you the plots of, especially these two books, because
they're easy to read.
It's just little like tidbits of somebody's life. Like, there's not really a strong plot. We wouldn't really be spoiling anything.
No.
Well, maybe a couple of things. Okay.
Anyway, so the Alcott family were transcendentalists. What do you think that is?
Transcendentalists?
Yeah.
Just don't fucking know.
Well, I assumed it was transatlantic dentists, but then I says the context cues don't reveal this.
Yeah. Would be strange to also make that a singular word and like a specific term.
Yeah.
Transatlantic dentists.
So essentially there was a specific kind of Christianity. I'm not entirely sure what they were, but they seemed nice.
To be honest, most of the sects of Christianity blend together for
the
me.
The sects.
Not the sex. The sects.
Anyway, they hashtag love Jesus.
Yeah.
So it's largely autobiographical, as we've mentioned. So the main hero of our story is Josephine March. She's the second eldest, with Meg above her and then Beth and Amy below her. Alcott herself was an abolitionist and a staunch feminist, so we stan.
Queen.
She never married throughout her life and used her skill with words to earn money and gain independence. And actually, she wrote a lot of sensational and immoral stories, which were sold anonymously because they were so scandalous.
Bringing back 50 Shades of Grey here. Tell me it's not the 50 Shades of Grey of 1868.
No, but those ones would be the 50 Shades of Grey. It's like as if...
Maybe. Only if they were massive sellers.
Yeah, so true. So essentially, we follow these four sisters throughout their lives, and it's kind of a coming-of-age story, but really it's kind of an epic family saga.
Oh.
Would you say that?
I don't know. I don't know if I would call it epic, because
Lovely
family, because it's very quiet.
It is very quiet.
It feels gentle. Very domestic.
Yeah, it is.
You know, it doesn't have these massive ambitions to completely revolutionize the way that you think about the world. It's supposed to just slowly follow these four women as they develop throughout life, you know?
So the March family is living in genteel poverty. They're not impoverished, but they do struggle, and which means that Meg and Joe have to work. And because the reason why they have to work is because the patriarch of the family, Mr. March, is off being a chaplain in the Civil War. And so this is like a really good device which allows like the entire world of Little Women to be completely female-centric. Mm-hmm. We only really learn about the world from women, and the men in the story are always perceived from women's perspectives.
Yeah. Also, the men in the story are accessories to the woman's stories, you know, they're never the center point.
So the story opens with a Christmas scene where all the girls are feeling really sad about the absence of their father, and their mother, who they call Mommy, is teaching the girls that giving is better than receiving, and encourages them to donate their gifts and money and spare food to others. And Mr. Lawrence, who's the neighbour, who's very, very wealthy, witnesses this and sends over food and presents to treat them for their act of goodwill. And this is kind of where this novel really starts. And Mr. Lawrence has a grandson called Theodore, who everybody calls Laurie, and he becomes Joe's best friend and a really key character in the story.
Where do you get Laurie from the name Theodore?
Lawrence. Theodore Lawrence. Laurie.
So he went for the last name.
He went for the last name. But Joe, because she's quirky, calls her Teddy.
Can you call me Robbie?
No, I don't like it.
I'll call you Dory.
Dory?
So getting past the plot, I think that the biggest thing that we need to address, and quite simply, I don't have an explanation for this.
It's just simple. We
know. What we know to be true is that Jo is a lesbian. Okay. She's just quite simply is. And it actually explains a lot of her actions throughout the novel.
Yeah.
Like the fact that
she has this really close friendship with Laurie, and Laurie is like, oh God, he's just an angel, and he's
everyone
funny,
loves him,
and he's hot, and he's tall, and he's in love with Jo.
Yeah.
And he kind of just sits around being like, I'm in love with you, and Jo's like, ha ha, good one.
Let's go in the outdoors.
Let's go run in a field.
Yeah.
And spoiler alert, Jo doesn't marry Laurie. Which makes no sense to people if you're reading Jo as like a straight character, because, well, we don't want to force people to be with, we don't need to ship people that don't want to be with each other. But
they're sort of inseparable. Like, and especially
like,
in.
It's like, okay, no, it's like us.
Yeah, but also, you got to remember, this is fictional. Like, it's not like it's a real relationship. If you're reading this as two characters that form this really close friendship and then grow up together, you sort of assume that it's a romance.
Well, it's like how our families thought we were going to get married.
And we are.
And we are. But I would... Okay. That's all that needs to be said.
Yeah. So, yeah, as we were saying before, the book, Little Woman, completely lovely and pleasant, except for one absolute bombshell. Big spoiler alert coming up, but I feel like by everyone knows.
If you've seen Friends, though, they talk about the spoiler on Friends.
Like, if Little Woman is being talked about this scene.
This is
talked about the fact that Beth dies.
Beth dies. Beth is literally an angel.
Literally?
She is the best of all of us. She is the icon. She is Mother Teresa. Actually, I don't think Mother Teresa was a very good person. I don't know.
Who is an angel? Well, she's an angel both
she's
in
Princess
terms of her
Diana.
Morals and no. also because she's now dead.
So true.
So she's been...
She's just like the kindest and softest character in the story. And she doesn't take up a lot of space in the story. But I think that's kind of like really important because she is just shy and bashful. But at her core, she just wants to play music and hang out with her dolls and be friends with people. And then she dies.
But that's also what makes it so heartbreaking is like the fact that she wasn't a major character, you know, like.
But she had this big impact.
She did have this massive impact. And like her death is a major event in every single character's life, as it would be in
especially
real life.
Especially Jo's. I think the thing is that there's this, because I've just finished it, there's this passage after Beth's death where Beth assumed herself to be this really bashful, very, very shy person that didn't make very much of it. She didn't feel that sad about dying because she said that she didn't feel like she made very much an impact on life. And there's this kind of paragraph talking about how everybody in the small town where they live is just devastated by her loss. And in a way that Beth never understood and never will understand, I literally will cry right now. But anyway, she just touched everybody's heart. She touched ours.
She did.
And it's a big turning point for Jo. She has to kind of reassess. Before Beth's death, Jo really didn't want to do anything expected. She wanted to write and be off and be free. But with Beth dying, she came home to take care of her. And it did round out her character. It made her, I don't know, more complex, rounded out her character to be more rounded. Okay, she's a circle.
She is a circle. But I also think, like, I mean, kind of slipping Anne of Green Gables into here, that's something that both Jo and Anne have in common is this idea that they will always make sure that their family comes first.
Yeah.
And that their family is protected and they will return from achieving their goals and dreams and ambitions to make sure that...
Well, that their goals are really important, but the thing that matters most is the people that they love. God, we really took a really...
Well, that took a turn.
A real... Yeah.
But yeah, in the book, it's sort of touched upon that all four of the characters have got quite different characteristics.
Yeah,
They're all quite unique.
Defined.
And sort of together, cumulatively, they create this all-American girl trope that was pretty popular in a lot of novels at the time. So Meg is sort of, she's the domestic and beautiful one. Jo is the strong-willed and passionate one. Amy is the showwoman and the artist, and Beth is gentle and intelligent. And sort of together they become that all-rounded, all-American girl.
I think the thing that I really, having looked a little bit deeper at the book, I really find impressive is that, like, essentially each girl in the story is on a spiritual journey. And they talk a lot in the book about this, it's not a biblical text, but it's a religious text called The Pilgrim's Progress. And it's about, it's a retelling, I think it's the New Testament. I don't know.
I also don't even know what you're talking about.
No, they, you know how they play the game, The Pilgrim's Progress, and they have, you know, they have their burdens.
Yes.
But it's actually a real book.
Right.
It's a real text about.
What is it?
I don't know.
We're now typing up what Pilgrim's Progress is.
Pilgrim's Progress is a, so Pilgrim's Progress is a novel by John Bunyan, and it's essentially kind of an allegorical story about overcoming, I guess, your own sins. But it's not as black and white as that. It's more like each person has a burden that they have to carry on their pilgrimage.
Yeah.
And so each of the sisters has, I guess, what would we call it now? Like, not a fault, a flaw.
Especially what they would define as their defining flaw. Not necessarily, this isn't coming.
We don't think they're
This isn't flaws that we think that the girls have. It's what they think they have. It's what they are sort of most
but
self-conscious
even,
about.
Even in ourselves, like I'm not going to tell you all my flaws, but I know some of the things that I would like to work on. You know, and that's what the story is about, is each sister knows the things that they want to work on in their life. So Meg is vain because she's so beautiful, and Jo has a really fiery temper, and Beth is super shy, almost to her detriment, and Amy is selfish. And so, like, the whole novel, as it goes on, these things are overcome by each of the sisters in their own way. So with Jo's temper, there's an altercation between Jo and Amy where Amy burns Jo's entire novel that she's been writing, and Jo gets so angry that she doesn't talk to her, and then Jo and Laurie go out to go ice skating and Amy follows them, and Jo knows that it's dangerous but just ignores that Amy's there, and Amy falls through the ice and almost dies in the cold water. And so this is the turning point for Jo and her temper. She has to learn to control. She can't just be this angry about things. She has to understand that Amy's a child, and, you know, yes, she burnt the novel, but she can write it again, and her sister is more important than this.
Yeah.
And so, and Meg has the same kind of arc where she goes to a debutante ball and she indulges herself in all of her vanities. And I don't know, she kind of just, she loses her actual character.
She kind of, well, she spends a lot of time with the other girls in the village, and they sort of bring her up going like, yes, you look so amazing. And she's like, this isn't actually what I want. She sort of has that self-reflection moment, which isn't as dramatic as almost killing her other sister, but it's much more reflective.
So those are just some examples of the way that they overcome these, I guess, what they see as flaws.
Yeah.
The other thing that I find really interesting is that each sister kind of has, they each have artistic skills in different ways. Jo can write, and Meg can act, and Amy can draw, and Beth can play piano and sing. And but for them to reach the end of the novel where they kind of are women, each of them, well, not Beth dies, so she's fine.
But the other three.
The other three, they have to give up their kind of passions and talents to exist as wives and mothers in the world.
It's devastating.
Which is devastating, and it's kind of played off in the book as like a positive thing.
Yeah.
But I think that it's like, you can sense the narrator's,
it seemed
just
imposed, you know, don't you think?
And there is like some discourse about how much Louisa May Alcott, the ending of the story, how much that was her intention. Because there was, like, the publishers didn't want to, said that they couldn't publish a story where one of the, so Jo wasn't initially going to be married at the end.
Yeah.
But they couldn't publish a story where the girls didn't get married at the end. They had to get married or they had to die. So.
Yeah.
And so there is this kind of discontent in the narrator. And so, like, is Alcott making a statement about how, like, women actually have to make these immense sacrifices to become good little women, you know?
Yeah. And she's also kind of commenting on sort of herself and how she had to give up a piece of her art by not being able to write the way that she actually wanted to.
Yeah, exactly. It's and because she wrote those other sensational stories, which I think she probably really enjoyed writing. And you see that in the book as well, because she, so Jo has this romance with Professor Bear, who's an older man, and he, essentially she shows him the sensational stories that she's been writing in the story. This is Jo, not Louisa. She's been writing these sensational stories, which have been providing her with a lot of money and a lot of independence. And Mr. Bear goes, these fucking suck, this drivel. Like, why would you do this? Like, I can't believe you'd give up your artistic integrity to just make money.
Yeah.
Which I think is so shit. Like, who cares if she's making money? Have that independence, you know?
Yeah. It's just really upsetting.
Yeah. Cool. So, what did you think of the movie?
The movie?
The 2020 movie of Little Women.
Oh, it was quite simply splendid and delightful.
It came out on my birthday, and what a treat, what a way to start the year.
Oh, it was just, it perfectly captured the essence of the book.
And also the way that Greta Gerwig, like, did the pacing.
Yes.
How there was the two forwards and backwards storylines.
Yeah.
Really, I don't know, made it so succinct.
Yeah, and modernized the most crucial aspects of the novel that required to be modernized. I mean, basically going off what we were just talking about before, where the different sisters had to give up their art, a lot of that is sort of removed from the movie. And sort of it's almost a more pure telling of what Louisa May Alcott intended.
I think Louisa May Alcott would be so happy with the 2020 movie.
Yeah, exactly.
Greta Gerwig, if you're listening, we love you.
Greta Gerwig is definitely listening to this.
Yeah, we love you, okay. Talk to you later.
Saoirse Ronan, you're
fucking
an
idol.
Fucking queen.
Sensational. We do have to talk about the elephant in the room, Timothy Chalamet Goop.
Oh, Timothy Chalamet Goop.
He wears the velvet jacket at Meg's debutante ball with the velvet tie and it's the green sexual awakening, okay, sexy.
Yeah, I mean, my sexual awakening was probably the saber-toothed tiger from Ice Age.
No way. I loved him. He's so...
Quite simply. Okay, I don't know why, but there's something about him, man.
God.
Those fangs.
For me, it was probably Orlando Bloom in Pirates of the Caribbean.
Yeah. And also Elizabeth Swann in Pirates of the Caribbean.
And also Jack Sparrow.
Yeah. So kind of the entire cast of Pirates of the Caribbean was also our sexual awakening.
Not Davy Jones.
Is that the tentacle man?
Yeah.
Yeah, not him. The others.
We asked our flatmates about this. We also got Shego from Kim Possible. So true.
Very
and
true.
Also Blue Jennifer Lawrence.
I think that's the X-Men girl.
Yeah. I don't know.
I think just concluding our thoughts on Little Woman, the takeaway message from the book and the movie is that family sticks together, kind of like Fast and the Furious, you know? Like, we are family.
I cannot believe that.
Amy is so offended that I just compared Little Woman to Fast and Furious.
You've gone 50 Shades of Grey. Okay, now you're going Fast and the Furious. Also, which one? Fast and the Furious.
Yeah, I don't even know if I've watched the last
few. Too Fast, Too Furious.
But Furious 8, or whatever they're called. But I swear in every single one, they're like, we are family, and that means we stick together. And that is also the message of Little Woman.
Okay.
But speaking of, like, the importance of family, that leads us into Anne of Green Gables, where it kind of shows the power of a
chosen
created
family.
You know, it's not necessarily the family that you're born with that counts at the end of the day. I'm going to rephrase that. It's not
your family doesn't matter, okay? But your friends, okay, the boys are life.
It's always about the boys.
It's always about the boys.
That is the consensus from Anne of Green Gables. So yeah, Anne of Green Gables, it's kind of about the importance of a chosen family, right? Like, as opposed to necessarily your natural
your blood
family.
Relatives.
Yeah,
you
which,
know.
I mean, can be the same as your chosen family. Yeah. And in a few instances, it is. But for a lot of people, they find that they drift away from their blood
especially
family.
Especially at our age, you know.
Yeah.
People are making new friendships at university and being away from their blood family and maybe finding out what's really important to them. And that's kind of what Anne of Green Gables is about.
Yeah. Well, like, I guess Anne is slightly different in that she doesn't have any blood family left.
Yeah.
Slightly different to uni
so,
students.
Good segue. Anne is an orphan.
Anne, orphans are very similar to uni students being an hour away from their parents.
Shut up.
Okay, so I'm just going to give you a really quick rundown on Anne of Green Gables. Again, not going to talk about the entire plot. So Anne is this 11-year-old rambunctious orphan, and she gets accidentally sent to these siblings, Matthew and Marilla Cuthbert, who wanted a boy.
Yeah.
And
they make that
clear. She arrives and they're like, what the fuck? I wanted a boy. This is some stupid girl. And Anne is like, I don't care. I'm dramatic and I'm loud and you're going to deal with it.
Yeah.
And initially Marilla goes, no, I'm not. I'll send you back. And then she eventually starts to really love her. And
well, they don't send her back initially because Matthew is just in love with Anne.
Well, Matthew is just a GC, quite frankly.
He's like the Beth.
He is the Beth. He just sits on his rocking chair and he goes, everyone calm down. I love everyone.
Yeah.
And Marilla goes,
okay.
You're so right.
So true.
Yeah. But over the course of the novel, she develops this close friendship with a local girl named Diana and a rivalry with Gilbert Blythe as they vow to be the smartest in the class. Yeah. And just the whole novel is basically Anne going on these many little adventures around Avonlea, interwoven with a serial story of Anne forming new relationships with people.
Mm-hmm.
And the audience really gets to see her mature from an overexcited child to a young woman. So, you know, quite a similar story arc to Little Woman.
So she does have some personal flaws that she has to kind of learn from. You know, she's been brought up in a kind of confusing space where she's been an orphan, and for a while she worked for a family where she looked after younger children than her. And so she kind of has to navigate a totally different world than what she's used to, and also kind of rein in her passion, I guess.
I think a massive thing with Anne is that she struggles to differentiate between emotions that she's actually feeling for herself and emotions that she feels like she should be feeling.
She has issues with emotional regulation.
Which
is common in people that don't have strong attachment figures when they're small.
Basically, Anne is the most extra person.
So extra,
ever.
We're here for it.
We fucking love it. One little example is she, I think it's like the first day of class, and she goes into school and she forgets to take her hat off.
Well, and, you know, the thing is she's decorated her hat with fresh flowers and ribbon.
Well, she's very, she loves fashion and she's very proud of her hat and she's very proud of her outfit. And she goes and she forgets to take off her hat and she is mortified. Yeah. And she says she felt like a crushed morsel of humanity.
Yep. And the other thing that I love about Anne is she is not afraid to feel things.
Oh, no.
You know, and like Marilla is like, she's really strict and kind of repressed and doesn't express anything. But Anne, she's just out here feeling it all.
Yeah.
And I think that's kind of such a powerful message for especially a girl's story when like, often we just have to kind of keep things inside. But Anne is like not like that. And she never apologizes for crying. And she cries a lot.
She does.
And she's just out here feeling stuff. And that's great.
And she's really open about it. Like this isn't from an internal dialogue.
No.
She's just very openly like, I'm really upset and I'm going to cry for hours now. Okay?
Yep.
And also, I remember reading the book. And one thing that I wanted to steal for myself was the term
bosom friend.
Like, it's just such a fantastic... It's so
warm
and cuddly.
Ah!
We are each other's bosom friends. But, like, just it sounds so warm and welcoming. I think it's because it kind of harkens back to cuddling your mum.
Yeah.
You know, she's a bosom mum.
And I love that in the story as well, Anne is like to Diana, who is her bosom friend.
Yes.
She goes, oh my God, we're kindred spirits. I think we should be bosom friends. And Diana's like, haha, I don't really know what that means, but like, okay. And like, it's not like that common. And like, Anne is saying this because she's read this in an even older book than when we're reading it. And kind of Diana's like, aha, cool. I love that. cool, let's do it.
That's kind of their whole dynamic too.
Yeah, it is.
And it's just like, let's do this, and they start saying this, and Diana's like, ha ha ha.
Okay.
Woo-hoo.
She's the best. She's so supportive.
She is the supportive friend, okay? Yep. She would ride or die. She is her ride or die, okay?
She rides for her man.
She rides for her woe man.
So true.
So a major thing with Anne as a character is actually the fact that she has ginger hair. Like, I don't, like, that's not something that, like, we think is relevant. They talk about it a lot, but also it sort of becomes a metaphor for her own self-acceptance. Like, at the beginning of the book,
they do go on and on about how she's ginger and freckly.
Yeah, and she's like, I hate it. I hate every single thing except for her nose. She quite likes her nose.
Loves her nose.
But hates her hair, hates her freckles. But by the end, she sort of starts to see the beauty in the fact that she has hair that's different to everybody else's.
Yeah, and then it kind of represents her inner passion and strength. And there is a point at which she buys some hair dye from a traveling man, and it dyes her hair green. And she says that as soon as she put the hair dye in, she knew it was a mistake, which I feel like we've all had that with a haircut, you know?
Don't you dare fucking attack me like this, Amy. I almost just called you Anne.
Okay. Which hairstyle for you?
I think that the snot green was
a mistake. It
was a mistake. Yeah, that one didn't really work. But the pastel green did.
The pastel green hair
was good.
Was it just that Grace was really bad at doing it?
Yeah, it was lockdown. So there are other characters other than Anne, I promise. Like, there's also Gilbert, who we were talking about before.
Gilbert Blythe is my life.
Yeah, and maybe not when he's like 11.
Oh, no.
But later on,
He's so hot.
We actually asked our flatmate Lulu what she thought of Gilbert.
We didn't even ask her what she thought of Gilbert. We said, what did you think of Anne of Green Gables? And she said, Gilbert is hot. And then she said
that Gilbert is infuriating, bewitching, and the crush you'd love to hate. And with those same inflections, by the way, with those dramatic pauses.
And because he is. Like, so initially Gilbert gets on the wrong side of Anne because he, on the first day of school, makes fun of her ginger hair.
Big mistake.
Yeah, big mistake. And he essentially spends the rest of the novel trying to, like,
make amends.
But one of Anne's fatal flaws is that she doesn't forgive very easily.
No.
And she also, like, and so we have this, like, lovely romance where, like, Gilbert's really trying to be nice. And Anne's like, I fucking hate you. But she's also like, I'm so in love with you. You know, like, and she just, Gilbert is very, like, Mr. Darcy. You know, like, he's silent and kind of grumpy. And he will argue with you.
But so sexy. Nice and sexy.
We love him. We love Gilbert.
He's so gorgeous.
Gilbert just wants to become a doctor and be cool. Did you know that there's 7 books after Anne of Green Gables?
Yeah, I was literally about to say that. There's so many fucking books. You've read them all?
I've read them all.
Even
Anne
the ones,
of Avonlea.
Even the ones
Anne
after
of the Windy Willows.
When it's not really Anne and it's about her kids.
I skim read those ones.
Skim read?
Like, I just read it real fast. Skim read. It's when it's not full fat, you know?
I just, like, can't imagine skim reading an entire novel.
Well, they're not really novels. They're like 100 pages. They're children's stories. Anne of Green Gables is the longest one.
Yeah, we should actually mention this. Anne of Green Gables is a children's story. It's not really like...
But I did reread it last year and it fucking holds up. So go away and read it.
I read it like 2 years ago, like during university
time.
It's
not really like a children's story in the way that we know children's stories now, where it's boring.
What?
I don't know. I would like to talk about how much Anne loves puff sleeves, because same. And right now, like, sleeves are back. And when I read this the first time when I was 11, I was like, the fuck would you want a puff sleeve for? I was very into that phase where it was like the short, like, cap sleeves and the long, tight body of the t-shirt, you know?
Yeah.
Dark times, 2011. So gross. But now I'm like, I want the puffier sleeve, the better.
Of all time. Yeah.
And there is a beautiful point in the novel where Matthew finally gets her a puff sleeve dress, and it's brown, I think.
I believe she cries.
She cries, and I would too.
Same.
Yep.
And I just love that Anne, maybe naughty girl's not the right word, but she is just the cheekiest little girl and kind of the antithesis of what women were supposed to be at the time, especially little girls. And this is especially complemented by the conflict between Anne and Marilla mm-hmm. throughout the entire novel. You know, Marilla
She's who women should be.
Yeah, she represents...
Should in quotation.
Yeah, she they both interpret Avonlea differently.
Mm.
And Marilla sees it as a set of strict rules and expectations that Anne has to abide by.
Mm.
And Anne sees it as Avonlea is the place of freedom. There's yep. so much room to go and do
she
whatever
often says
you want.
It's a land of dreams.
Yeah, so like they have these different perspectives and they don't really come together.
I think the thing that's really lovely about Anne of Green Gables is that Anne is... Again, she's like the antithesis to that idea that children should be seen and not heard.
Yes.
Like Anne consistently makes herself heard. And when people are wronged, she will fucking tell them
yeah.
that you have like, this is not okay. And she stands up for every person. And I think that's like such a powerful story for children to read, that like your voice does actually matter and your feelings matter and are listened to. And all of these things make you a better person, not a worse person.
Yeah.
Anyway, who is your favourite Anne of Green Gables character?
Look, I don't want to say it, but Anne, she's just so charming.
Yeah.
Like, I know that that's so cliche saying the main character, but she is just the best.
Yeah.
You know? For and, like, me, she is kind of annoying at the beginning.
She
like,
is.
Right when you're first reading, you're like, God, is she going to be like this the entire time? Just, like, going off on random tangents. And then you're like, I love these random tangents.
Yep.
And it's like me,
yeah.
you know?
Yeah.
Oh, just love her.
I would have to say Matthew. He's just, like, so kind. And he gives Anne, like, all of the love that she didn't get earlier on.
Yeah.
And he's just such a positive influence on Anne's life, and but also Marilla's life in the end, you know?
He's just so pleasant yeah. and lovely.
Have you seen the show?
No.
Anne
what show?
Anne with an E?
No.
It's on Netflix. It's really good.
Okay.
It's really good.
It delves
into kind of the darker things about Anne's life, you know, the fact that she was in an orphanage and what kind of things that might have... how that might have actually affected her, regardless of it being a children's story. It's
yeah,
really, really interesting.
Because that aspect is kind of brushed over a bit in the book.
Really brushed
like,
over.
She's considered an orphan. Well, like, the fact that she's an orphan is only really touched on at the beginning, and then afterwards it's like...
And she's also farmed out as labour to a family of, like, five babies, and she's, like, 10. And
yeah,
she
yeah that's right.
And so, like, the show really explores those kind of darker
the impact
things
of that.
And the, like, ramifications of her not knowing who she is and where she comes from. And also it does a really good job, I think, of like weaving in modern inclusivity into a story that's, you know, old and white.
Yeah.
So like I think it's a really good way, if you don't want to read the book, it's a good way to access the same kind of...
Expanding the story to be accessible to a wider range of people.
Mm. Yeah, definitely.
Yeah. Well, I'll definitely give it a shot. Thanks, Aim.
Ooh. Wait, we didn't talk about how Aunt Josephine's also a lesbian.
And we also can't justify that. We just need to say that the
so
Joes...
Diana's great aunt, Josephine, yeah. who lives in the city, they go and stay with her. And it's like briefly mentioned that she used to have a female companion, but
lesbian.
She's just died. And actually during the time that this was written, there was this common thing called a Boston marriage, which was actually was an official marriage between women. And
really?
Yeah. And historians said they were just friends. They were just like, Google it. It's really cool. Like Boston marriages. So there was this kind of legitimate avenue where women could live together in love, but they just said, oh, we're just companions. They weren't, you know.
Auntie Josephine 100% would.
And also, like, what if Aunt Josephine is Joe March?
I know. Both Joes, both lesbians.
Both amazing.
Much to think about there. So, you know, there is a reason that we talked about these two books together.
Mm.
They're in the same universe.
They are.
All right, let's tie it back. I have one last question for you, Amy, before we really wrap it up with Judge a Book by Its Cover.
Yeah.
Which March sister... am I?
Oh, God.
I know which one you are.
I think you're Amy. Have I ruined our friendship?
Amy's only the most hated one.
She's my favourite character.
She is also kind of a queen. Especially
she just kind
Florence
of that...
Pugh is like, yeah, she is very relatable.
You have a kind of strength of character and I don't give a shit attitude. and you want to do the things that will make your life sensational, cool.
Sounds good. Hey, look, it doesn't need to be justified.
I think that you are happy.
I'm happy with being Amy. To be honest, all four of the characters have significant faults.
I think the reason why I know that you're Amy is because you know what you want and you know how to get it and you're not afraid to do that.
Struth.
You know? And like there are aspects of you that are like Joe, where you're creative and funny and a bit quirky, you know, and you're very kind like Beth. But really, you know, you're a savage. You're a classy, bougie, ratchet savage.
True.
Like Amy.
See, I think that you are, I mean, we're both like all of them.
Yeah, so true. Who's not?
But I think that you are most like Beth.
Really?
Is that shocking?
Yeah.
No, I think you're, sometimes you're a little bit shy, but when you are allowed to get out of your shell, you're just sort of like this warm glow of light and
oh my God,
everyone
that's so
sort of
nice.
Loves you.
I didn't think you were going to, I thought...
What did you think I was going to say?
I don't know. Maybe Joe. I write. I don't do any of the other
Joe
things.
The fact that you both write is the only similarity between you and Joe.
Yeah, maybe Amy. She's a feminist.
So that kind of concludes our thoughts on Little Woman and Anne of Green Gables. And now we're moving on to...
And now for the part of the show where Charlie and Amy literally judge a book by its cover.
That's right. It's judge a book by its cover, which... basically means that we judge a book by its cover. And today we've got On the Ball by Gordon Slater. The Centennial Book of New Zealand Rugby. And
Where did you find this?
I found it in the Law Common Room in the Richardson Building. And I chose this one because I know for a fact... that this is getting a 0 out of 10 for me.
Yeah.
I mean, like...
I just hate the typography. Like, why are the words spaced like that? Why do they look like that? Why is the N... something about the N on the ball is really giving me bad vibes. So let's describe the cover. Essentially, there's a photo of a rugby scrum. There's the All Blacks, I think. And then there's a red team. It's Red England?
Is that a scrum or is that a try? What is that?
We don't know.
Why are they all facing in the same direction? I swear rugby players are supposed to go against each other.
Hey, I just don't know. I would like to know from when the centennial... what is that measured from?
Yeah, I don't know how old this book... like, it looks pretty old.
It looks pretty old. But when did rugby start?
I don't know.
So many questions.
I'm so glad that I chose a rugby book for me and Amy to talk about.
The back says that there's a foreword by Billy Wallace. I don't know who that is, but I like that his name could hypothetically be Billy Wally.
I don't really know what this book is going to be talking about. The blurb says
all the great matches, all the famous players, all the thrills of New Zealand rugby from school playing fields to international grounds.
Like, are they just going to be giving us... a run through of every
single game that's ever been played, or is it about how rugby? See, now I'm kind of I kind of want to read it.
What?
I know. I have so many questions.
I do actually quite like the way that the back cover looks.
Yeah, me too. I think it's kind of cool.
There's sort of a couple of barriers. So like the top third is where the blurb and the foreword by Billy Wallace words are, and then the bottom two thirds are split.
Have used the rule of thirds in design, which is weird. It's the rule of thirds. You should know what that is. Essentially, they're splitting it into kind of three places, which makes that the top bit more readable than the bottom bit, and then the bottom bit exists in its own right.
It's just quite dynamic and quite fun.
It is, but I don't like the front of it. So
I also hate that it's about rugby.
Okay, what do you rate it?
I rated it.
How many rugby balls out of five rugby balls?
Two flat rugby balls out of five. Are we rating it out of five now?
Well, just for this one.
Okay, two out of five rugby balls.
Is five a score in rugby? Did they go in fives?
I think it's a try.
I thought a try was three, and then two was a conversion.
I don't know.
Two flat rugby balls out of five rugby balls. Okay, I'm going to give it two full rugby balls out of five rugby balls. No, that seems generous. 1.5 full rugby balls.
Right, okay.
Which I think is the same as two flat rugby balls.
Yeah, I would say that they're about equatable, but would I read it? Absolutely not.
Yeah, me neither. But I do have questions. But questions I don't really need the answers to.
No, questions I can look up on Wikipedia, to be quite frank. Next week, we're talking about Percy Jackson. All five books. It's going to be great. Can't wait.
It's going to be so good. You know, Percy Jackson is the reason why I minor in classics.
As you fucking should.
Anyway, we'll discuss that next time.
I think Percy Jackson is the reason most people are minoring in classics.
So true.
All
okay,
right, we'll talk
bye.
About it next time. Bye.
That was a Radio 1 91 FM podcast. You can find more of them at r1.co.nz/podcast.